Welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon.
And I'm Gwen Douglas.
Today we're doing
the Jura,
which is one of my favourite regions. And I've got such a soft spot for it.
I think that's what I've been reading, that it's like every sommelier's sort of like the darling of the sommelier world.
It's definitely become like the hipster appellation.
But I mean,
it wasn't always the case.
Stuff. No?
No, it wasn't always the case. I know that it's quite interesting because there used to be a wine shop in Hackney that was called 259.
Okay.
That used to only have Jura wine. So they
had
Auvenoir, Ganavat, all of these amazing producers. And that's all they sold because the wines were totally like...
Unknown.
Oh, wow. So they got like loads of allocation of the wines. And they were getting calls. Already the Jura kind of... hype was taking off in the US. They were getting calls from New York saying like, what can I buy? Can I buy anything? And they weren't selling to them. And that was in, I think that closed in around 2012, 2013.
Would that just have been that now there was more, like they just didn't have the wines anymore?
Well, they moved to Berlin, actually. You know, one of the guys that set up there, who now lives in Portugal.
Yes, Lottie Daddy. Yes, okay.
Him and Milena. It was their shop in London. And then... So, and I remember at that time in 2012, I was in my first buying job, and it was the first time I had tried wines from this region, and it was Ganavat was the first producer. And I remember going out for lunch with David.
Not Kennedy. A bad first,
yeah. And I got taken out for lunch with a supplier, and he bought these two bottles, and I think we ended up even drinking them, and like it wasn't just a tasting,
right? You're just like,
this is so good,
yeah.
And I listed one of the wines from Ganavat, Cuvée Florine, by the glass in London for a year and a half. And I was the only person pouring it by the glass in London.
Wow.
And not because the price or anything like that.
It
was
just people didn't know.
And not many people knew the wines. Yeah. And now they're like allocation wines where they're really tricky to get hold of. Like that's how radically different it has changed
in a short
period of time.
It's amazing that even like fashion and tastes and things like this can change so much so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because now it's definitely one of the places that we touched upon in the last few episodes talking about prices going up on the secondary market. This is definitely a place that
happens
you see
all the time.
A lot of these Auvenoir, especially
miroir. Exactly. Yeah, and I think for good reason in some ways, the popularity part of it, not the prices,
but
the wines are so drinkable. I think that they, especially with, I think, where everybody's palates are at the moment, you know, lighter, fresher wines, mineral wines, more savoury wines.
Yeah, I was going to say, also like the sort of quirkiness that people crave these days too, that's something that's a little different and unusual.
Yeah.
I think there's like everything in Jura that you can have something
easy
drink and light and something complicated and complex and challenging.
And I think for those who don't know where the Jura is, for anyone who's in Germany, you might hear people say Jura, because it starts with a J. So that sometimes I've heard sommeliers saying Jura here, but I say Jura because that's what they say. So we're about 50 kilometers east of Burgundy, so very close to the Swiss border.
It's
where Comté cheese comes from. So it's between Burgundy and Switzerland. Cool climate, continental climate. So fresh wine's being produced there because of the climate. But the last one we're going to try today is kind of full-bodied and a bit out there.
Out there, yeah.
Yeah.
A little tougher. But then, I guess, like, grapes. So there are five major grapes, I guess, in Jura. Chardonnay.
For the white,
Sauvignon.
Yeah.
Poulsard.
For the reds,
Pinot Noir.
Yes.
And the last one was...
Trousseau,
I always forget. Yeah. Mr. Trousseau.
Yes. Mr. Trousseau. I'm imagining a little cartoon,
actually. I imagine a little bit like the...
With a little moustache, for some reason.
And an overcoat, some sort of like...
Yes, Manuel from Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, something like this, a little, like, small...
Someone from an Agatha Christie film.
Yes, totally.
One book, I should say.
I watched a sort of mystery today. Anyway, digress. So, Chardonnay, people know. I guess, like, what would be the way that the winemaking is made in Jura is how it sets it apart. Is that what's going on? Or is it also very different from places where we'd normally see Chardonnay?
Yeah, I think the soils are different. And there's depending where you are in the Jura, there's sort of clay soils on the flatter vineyards, the higher ones, limestone. And there's quite a lot of this soil type called marl, which is, particularly blue marl, is in the area of Chateau Chalon. So you often find that the Sauvignon is planted on the marl and the Chardonnay on the clay and the limestone.
Just the like Sauvignon Blanc is also grown on marl.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, like what you said, difference in wine style, but I would say as well, like for people who do like drinking Burgundian wines, right. actually there are quite a right. number of producers yes. that are great alternatives, and it's Agreed. Like a fraction of the price. It's just now impossible to get hold of some right. of the wines. yes. That's the difference. But the no, wines haven't, them, yeah. yeah, they haven't gone crazy. They've definitely gone up a lot in price.
Right.
Like maybe they're 150% or something. So like I used to buy them for early teens in the UK as a buyer, so maybe a €20 right. wine, maybe they're now like €30 wines
right.
or 35 yeah. or something. But yeah, so I think
yeah, it's to say that like not every wine from the Jura is the oxidative style.
No,
that
exactly. It's like,
there are some, but then there are some.
Yeah, and some of the like iconic upcoming producers, for example, Julien Labbé, pretty much all of his wines are topped up wines. They're non-oxidative. Okay.
Right.
So, and they've got the same kind of lovely texture, fine acidity. There's a lot of like crossovers right. with Burgundy in that way. Also producers vinifying wines from like multiple producers picking from single vineyards and putting the vineyards on the like the nice. Crew on okay. the labels as well. So you get to see winemaker expression of site cool. right. too. And also you see, you know, I really think it's a region for terroir as well. And a little fact as well about like some of the Chardonnay vines in the Jura, they're some of the oldest Chardonnay vines in France.
Oh, amazing.
Because it was never a commercial winemaking region in the same way.
It was just for drinking in that space sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a region actually where a lot of the wines stayed local. Like I remember okay. when I went, on one of my visits to the Jura, I was visiting a producer called Berthe Bondé. And they said, you know, like 10 years before, so like 2005, you wouldn't even get people from, like, it would be a surprise really? If somebody from outside of the Jura would come and visit your winery
wow,
from
amazing.
France. So now they're getting international right. people. So it's a very, very quick transition.
Right, it sounds really fast.
Yeah.
To go from like a sort of closed community, almost wine community, to suddenly being
yeah
a sort of gold star on the
yeah.
map.
Yes.
Wow.
And I mean, just to go back on that note, so the vines there, they were never pulled up and replanted for different clones, for example.
Okay.
So
right.
it's more, you know, it's very lot of small holdings. It's only 2,000 hectares under vine, so it's a small region anyway.
Yeah.
And the main industry there for sort of, I guess the most important industry was salt, actually.
Oh, really?
So there's quite a few producers that now keep their wine in old salt cellars.
Oh, that's
and stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
I actually yes. did not know any of that.
So a little bit of extra fact.
Yeah.
We should maybe get some wine in the glass while we
yeah,
carry
let's
on.
Let's do it.
So we've got your wine.
We're going to carve in them today because we're recording early in the week and I want to drink them later in the week.
That's fine.
We don't want to waste things.
So we're going to carve in this. And what have we got here, Gwen?
So let me get my notes up because I've never tried this one. This one was a recommendation. So it's I went to Passion Vin in Berlin. François Rousset-Martin. And it's a Pulsar from Neuvy-sur-Seille, a village tucked away in the Vallée des Reculés, where they make their wine. So apparently, yeah, it's just a nice, as far as I can tell from the description, should be a good description of what Pulsar should look like.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, the colour looks like it's spot
right.
on here.
Like,
so
I
it's got
say.
This kind of like orange bricky colour, even when it's young.
Yeah, this is what I was reading, that it always has this sort of light and that it also lends itself well to being made into white wine because of this lightness. Is that correct? Or did
Interesting.
They ever...
I haven't had a
maybe
a
that's
white
a,
from...
Maybe I'm confused.
Pulsar, but...
Probably confused.
No, but I mean, it'd be interesting. Good. I'm sure there's someone making it. Yeah, nice. Yeah, Pulsar for me is really... I mean, it's... Who... I mean, I... Yeah, let's...
The colour is...
Yes, it smells great, Gwen.
Mmm, yeah.
Yeah, what I love about this particular grape variety, it's not for everybody's taste, I think.
It's savoury, yeah.
Yeah, massively savoury. There's this spiciness to it, this earthiness to it.
It definitely has that, like, meaty little blood.
Yeah, almost like, and for me, that kind of bay leaf note, actually, which I haven't
totally.
Seen in it before, actually, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, light in colour, like low in tannin, high in acidity, very
really
fresh,
like
crunchy. You know, maybe this is for people that haven't tried this before, but are used to drinking maybe some of the like more natural wines from the Loire, for
right.
example, or some of the Loire red grapes. this, you know, or Pinot.
I was going to say it has some Pinot,
yeah,
memories of Pinot, yeah, but maybe a little, yeah, crunchier than Pinot might be in my,
yeah, head. Lighter. I think lighter, and I think less fruity as well.
Yeah,
and it's less aromatic.
But these are always so like easy to just smash at the dinner table. You know, yeah, this is like, I think why Lucas, my partner, loves Jura wines, and it's such a like sit around the dinner table after and just like drink bottle after bottle of Jura wines.
Yeah, because they've got something, they've got this really Moorish nature because of this racy acidity that's there, the mineral like component to the wines. And I think also they're just interesting because they're not fruit bombs, you know, right. So they kind of, there's sort of edges, this savoury edge the whole time to the wine, which is making it really appealing. At least that's what I like about it.
Are a lot of Poussins, are they generally oaked? Or because this definitely feels...
No, I would say in general, unoaked. Like, I mean, oak isn't... I was going to say oak isn't a thing in the Jura. I mean, everybody uses oak.
Into a certain
but usually extent. Large, old oak. I mean, particularly for the whites. I mean, for Vangeaune, when we get to it, we're talking about people keep using it for decades, if not hundreds, like centuries sometimes.
Well,
you know, they don't replace the barrels. And I would say this is also why one of the things I love about the Jura is that there really is this expression of fruit and expression of place, because it's not a region that the wines are heavily oaked and heavily manipulated.
Okay. Yeah, good to know. I mean, because a lot of people also often are turned off by wines from Burgundy, for example, because they're not super into oaky wines. Yeah. So maybe it's a nice place to go have a look and see if you like that lighter style that's un-oaked.
For sure.
I was just reading in my notes that I hadn't read before. Is it... Oh, he grew up... The winemaker actually grew up in Burgundy. His father's a microbiologist, which is interesting. So he apparently spent a lot of childhood trips growing in the Jura as a child, falling in love with a parcel of vines that he later vinified with his father. So actually that's kind of a nice romantic story of... the place, which it's very nice. So he talks about, I guess, wanting to know the terroir better, and this is, he has quite a big selection of wines. I think this winemaker makes lots of different...
Yeah, I saw that. It's difficult to distinguish them because actually the labels are so similar as well, aren't they?
Actually, trying to find any information about this winemaker was actually quite challenging, to be honest.
It's good that you found it. You found it from Kermit Lynch, though.
Yeah,
right?
Which that was the only place that really had a large amount of... That's good. But then they had lots of great info. So they make actually a lot of different... mostly white, just a couple of reds. Mm. But yeah, I would definitely buy this again for... I think Lucky will enjoy this later.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, going on to the just that note about multiple wines being made by producers, I mean, I went, when I visited Julien Labbé, I think we tried something like 36 different wines.
I mean, it's wild.
From bottle.
Yeah.
And I think there were some different vintages, obviously, but like still, you know, because it, again, like Burgundy, small plots.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And labelling the small plots as small plots.
I think that just makes it so much more interesting, especially if he's saying that this is something that drives him, is this like understanding of the relationship between terroir and taste, that of course then you feel like a winemaker like this wants to be exploring as many different computations of things to figure out what best suits there. It's funny, I was thinking about what I would eat with this. And I don't even eat rabbit, but for some reason I think rabbit would be amazing with this. It's like the first thing that popped into my head.
Yeah,
like
or even, I agree, like anything like guinea fowl, like kind of like
that light
game.
Yeah, right, light game.
And white meat, for sure.
So I think, rabbit stew with this would be, or even pasta, pasta dish would go well.
And what about, like, I mean, I'm thinking as well on the table where maybe you've got people going fish and poultry
actually, that's a great idea.
Yeah, because if there's no tannin.
Right, yeah. I could totally see that.
Delicious. This is beautiful, actually. It's very polished.
I'm very happy with this purchase. It's always nice when you buy something and you're like, yes, actually.
Especially if you're going on recommendation, right? I'm always nervous to trust people's recommendations.
And I've just started seeing this particular person working at the shop, so it's actually nice to... Building some trust.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, because now I know the recommendations I've gotten from him so far have been really nice, so... I mean, as we've talked about in the previous seasons, I love asking people for recommendations and buying things blind. But of course, then
I hate it.
Yeah, you're always at a risk. Then I overbuy because then you think like, "Fuck, what happens if this one is shit? Then I better get another one."
Yeah.
So you end up buying way more than you need, actually. So
I think it's definitely. there's nothing worse when you're in a restaurant and you've trusted someone with the recommendation, and then you're like, "Oh, I'm too English to tell you that I hate this." Yes, it's great. It's fine.
It's like the absolute worst when you're like,
it's awful.
That's what's great about drinking at home, you know? It's like the other day we opened something that was far too sweet and it was just one of those like, oh, let's try something else. Smash it in the fridge, we'll do this later.
I mean, the great thing about a sweet one is at least you've got a bit longer as well.
Yes, to deal with it.
Yeah, to deal with it.
To deal with it.
To get it down the hatch.
Yeah. To figure out how to consume it. This next one I love. I've definitely had this. I don't know if I've had this vintage. I can't remember what vintage this is.
So we've got Domaine de Tournelle Fleur de Sauvignon 2017, which I actually think is here on the wine list at Aura.
I'm gonna try and find more notes on
I think
it.
I think we've got some 16 and 17 in the cellar here. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Tournelle, particularly if they're whites. I think they make excellent whites.
Yeah, I think I also like a lot the Cuvée d'Automne. It's another one of my favorites that I usually drink at Brasserie La Mazère here. He always has these, which I like a lot.
We drank some Jura when we were there, actually.
Yeah.
We had some Labbé when you and I went.
Sure.
Pre-COVID.
Yeah. It smells really very lovely.
Oh my God, what a wine. Mm. So Sauvignon, not to be confused with Sauvignon.
And I actually only learnt today that it's part of the Treminor family.
Yes.
Which I find very...
Oh, of course. any excuse to plug some desserts from Mina.
I actually find it really amusing because Lucas, my partner's favorite region, is Jura. So it makes me laugh that like Sauvignon is like one of his go-tos. And so it just tickles me a little bit that it's part of the Gewürztraminer family. You have Treminor, Red Treminor.
Yes.
And then Sauvignon and Gewürztraminer being that little fam.
Look, I mean...
So happy. You see, it's like... Maybe Gewürztraminer is still just like the dorky cousin and Sauvignon is like the cool kid on the block, like the artsy kid.
Yes. But they're on the same block. Both.
Yeah, they're part of the same family, all right?
But you should do like a little Royal Tenenbaums like sketch of the Treminor family.
Of the Treminor family?
Look like.
Not a bad idea, actually. But this has such a nice nose on it, too. It has like...
This would probably be... what's her name? Gwyneth Paltrow's character, maybe.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Sort of.
What's her name again in that film?
I can't remember.
Margot.
Margot, there you go.
It has a really, it almost makes me think of, pear tart.
Yes. I mean, it's a non-aromatic grape variety, so it is different to Sauvignon or Gewürztraminer. But, and I always find that it's got, I mean, this particular one anyway, it's got this lovely kind of creamy edge. There's probably a little bit of malolactic or something that's gone on.
Oh, yeah,
on the
it back, says right
on
here,
the
yeah.
leaves, right?
Hang on, is there something? Yeah, malolactic fermentation in barrels following the spring with top-ups of the moulage.
And it's kept on its leaves for 2 years, it says on the back, too.
And then, yeah.
And this is a topped-up version, so this is non-oxidative. But what's quite nice about this is it's still wine with a lot of intensity on the palate.
Yeah, and they're still...
Energetic.
Yeah. There's still so much going on that I think you could,
and a lot of tension. Mm. This lovely razor sharp acidity. Imagine if this hadn't gone through malolactic and didn't have these aging.
It would be like
walking down Brighton Beach on a January.
I can already feel my stomach hurting thinking about that.
Yeah.
It would just be like, too much. Yeah, gasoline. But it's definitely, whenever if I see it on a list and we're looking for something, I mean, I like to order this one. I've bought lots of bottles of it. But I really think you can't go wrong with this.
Slight nutty edge as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's the because then you still get that
bitter almond.
That Jura nuttiness. Yep. But I feel like when we buy something from Jura, I'm
it's
always...
It's nutty and salty.
Yes, it's like walnuts and I love walnuts and that kind of anything with bitter finish I'm really a big fan of. So I think it gives you that nutty thing without being so intensely or being oxidative at all. So you kind of, you feel like you've got that, but don't have to deal with the...
And what's impressive about this wine is it's zero sulfur, right?
Without CO2.
Yeah. No unfiltered wines. It's fully natural and it's pristine.
It is
And this really is a region for natural wine producers as well.
Yeah,
I mean, for a small region, there's an abundance of natural producers.
I wonder if that's also part of its history of being a sort of closed-in community where it wasn't
tradition. It's traditional winemaking. It's not through
some
bad.
And it wasn't made to travel. So I think like when you have wines that are traditionally made in a place and not meant to travel, why would you be adding things if you're consuming them?
Yes, and also, I mean, one thing as well is just to be aware of is also I think pH as well. pH of the wine is lower as well, so you don't have to use the same amount. Of additions.
Interesting. I guess because then things don't grow as fast in that pH level.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much else to say about this one other than. Is it like a, would you class it as being like a representative of Sauvignon when you
Yes, 100%. A topped up Sauvignon from the Jura from a natural producer. It's an, I think, an excellent example of that.
Cool.
Yeah.
And I guess, is there, so the pear notes or pear on the nose, or it would be the sort of white fruit
orchard fruit and some citrusy notes. And then I think that saltiness, the nuttiness.
So I guess that like, I guess maybe that's why it works. It's often put in blends with Chardonnay also in that region.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
And I feel like those things all kind of work together. Orchard fruit and there's a nice. Yeah. I love this.
Yum.
Definitely be drinking this.
Yum, 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 yum.
On the balcony. Yup. That's Ludwig putting his 2 cents in. He's like, yes. It's delicious.
Mmm.
It was actually hard, I think, for us to pick, like, bottles to bring for this region because...
There's too many to choose from.
Yes, and it's like you kind of want to show everything because it's like... Mm. We talked about that also Jura makes sparkling.
Yes.
So they do also do crema and...
A Van de Pay as well, which is a sweet fortified. It's like... It's
like
a
Ripasso or
It's basically... It's like Pinot de Charente from Bordeaux. So it's a Mistel. Okay. So it's unfermented grape juice that has been fortified with a grape spirit.
Gotcha.
So I'm not a huge fan of this style of...
Okay.
Because I always find that you've got this very kind of grapey almost...
Like grappa or...
Because it's sweeter. And
it gives you that sort of like, the really like grape juice.
Yes, and it feels a little bit like this, you know, like that fake grape flavouring.
Yes, I love it.
I know, I thought you would. And it's just like, and then there's this kind of brandy edge to it that it just, I don't know.
I mean, I also love Macfin, which is also something else.
That, I mean, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm describing Macfin.
Yeah, that's
right
what
now.
I thought
not,
you were.
Not Van de Pay.
I was
know
like,
why I'm doing that.
So I was like, that sounds a lot like...
Van de Pay is the straw wine, but they dry them out on straw.
That's more like Ripasso,
which makes,
Yeah, and then Macfin is... Because Macfin, I like a lot. Yes, because I know that you're not a huge fan of the Macfin.
No, and I have a bottle of Macfin Rouge at my house, so when you come, we'll open it.
Yeah, because
every time I look at it, and I'm like... going to be there
basically all that
time.
Horrible stuff you have in your cupboard, it's the shit I love,
but people do really love Macfin.
I love it,
and I think obviously with cheese it could be great
of I think it's like a nice alternative to, I mean, I hang out with a lot of schnapps drinkers, so it's like if you're not a schnappsy person, it's also something nice at the end to have a splash off that's not as hardcore.
That Sauvignon is
so good. I know,
it's one of those wines that's dangerous because you're just like
you keep
it evaporates.
Back,
That's
why
that's
I wanted
to
carve in it, because I'm going to smash that in the
right moment.
Yeah.
After the work week is finished.
Maybe not. Maybe midway through the week when the sunshine is shining.
All that too, yeah.
We've been planning.
A day holiday in Berlin.
So the next one, I'm really actually happy that you brought a Vingeron, even though I have not loved drinking them in the past.
And this is not just any Vingeron. So this is 2012 Arbois Vingeron from Jacques Puffini, who no longer produces wine.
So.
And one of the most iconic producers. Like when he decided, he did 60 vintages.
Wow.
Of winemaking. And when he had no kids to take on the winery, so he sold it.
Wow.
And it was like.
I mean, you're right. Because why hang on to
the last vintage was.
Wowzer.
17 or 18. So I think this is the last... I think it was either 17 or 18 was the last vintage that he made. But the Vingeron will be... This is 13's the last vintage, I think, he produced of the Vingeron.
Wow,
so this
crazy.
Is the second to last vintage. Can't buy it anywhere now because it's completely sold out.
Because it does take a long time to make a Vingeron, right?
It's over 6 years. It's 6 years and 3 months that the wine has to be kept in barrels. So... Vingeron is always bottled in these 62 centiliter.
They're very charming.
Yeah, they are.
They're very like
very
old
French.
School, very French. I love it.
So they're always coming in this size bottle. And the reason for that is, they say, is that due to the winemaking method, which is the wine barrels are never topped up. And they're usually left with they're usually actually left with some air as well, and then the wine is left there and checked on, and something very unique happens because of the climate and conditions
and allow it to happen. Special yeast from that region, right?
Yeah, and that grows over the top of the wine and protects it from spoiling, and it's very similar to the floor that we see in sherry.
But I've heard that it's much thinner than the floor.
It's much thinner, and it's called a like sous-voile. It means under the veil.
So also romantic, under the veil.
And it does look like, it actually looks a little bit like a spider's web. Yeah, like lacy, you know, like it does.
Thin.
Yeah, whereas in sherry and in Jerez, it looks a little bit like a carpet.
I was going to say, like the liner under the carpets in the car, you know, like this sort of like underlining to a carpet.
Yeah. It does. So yeah, there's that. And six 6 years and 3 months in barrel before bottling. And so the bottle shape.
It's such a process for like.
Is due to the amount of that evaporation that would have been left from a standard bottle over that time.
Well, that's fascinating.
Because that's why, this is what's interesting about this as well. So it's 14% alcohol. It wasn't when it went into barrels. Right. That's because of as the water evaporates out, it concentrates the flavour and the alcohol.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's quite an intense wine.
Right.
So it's unfortified wine that's oxidatively made under a floor.
A veil of floor.
So it's unfortified sherry.
So when we talked about me, when I said I didn't enjoy eating it or drinking it, it's because I've had to, I would say, like, endure a bottle during a very light dinner, and the bottle that we had, and I can't remember what it was, it just sort of killed everything. So I would say this is the wine that, for someone like me or with my palate, that I needs to be well-placed. In the right context.
Yeah, I think so. Or, I mean, or you've just got to love it as well.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, so I said for someone like me who's not like, I mean, because I know people that love this stuff.
I mean, it's super umami, this wine. This is epic.
That's why, like, the people I know that love it are chefs.
Yeah.
They go bananas for it.
I mean, for me, it's just like some of the best wines I've ever had. Like, when you have an old Van Joan that's like decades old and it becomes even more umami, it takes on these like mushroomy, almost marmite-y kind of flavours. Yeah. Oh, it's just heaven on earth. Because also the acidity just drops a little bit as well. It's got very high acidity. Again, that's also something.
I mean, it has like a sake kind of a feeling about it because of this umami.
Umami, enoki mushroom kind of vibe. Right. So this is 100% Sauvignon. It's always 100% Sauvignon if it's Van Joan.
Okay.
This one's from Abois, but there's a smaller appellation called Chateau Chalon, which is blue marl, and that's always Van Joan style wines. So if you see Chateau Chalon, it's this style of wine.
And what I was reading about that particular appellation is that they come and check the grapes every year, and basically if the grapes are not up to snuff, they won't allow them to make it for that year.
Yeah, so you know that it's going to be good quality.
Yes, so when you see that on the label, you know that it's like top notch. That's not to say that Van Joan's from other regions, because it is made in other regions or under the appellation of Van Joan.
Other parts of the Jura, just Van Joan.
Van Joan,
That's what we're trying now.
So it's exactly not to say that if it's not from that region, it's not good.
And these can't, because this producer was located in Arbois, so they're coming from there.
I mean, it smells amazing, but it's also one of these like. That's why when I say, like, for me, it's something that needs to be in the right context, is that I either want to be eating the right food or just in the right headspace. Because I just don't think this is something I would open every day or in just any which day. It has actually a real caramelly, salty. Mm. It's a very interesting smell.
Yeah, I love it. And, I mean, traditionally, two things to eat with this. Mm. One, Comté, obviously. It's, like, the best pairing for Comté cheese. Mm. And... Changing your mind?
This one's pretty interesting.
Mm.
It almost has like more fruit in the taste than I think I would imagine.
Okay.
Like a sort of caramel apple salted nut pastry.
Yeah. And so Comté cheese would be my pairing.
I mean.
And then the most, one of my all-time favourite dishes... Which is actually, I'm so amazed, actually, it's on the menu at the new Noble Wine in Soho. So it's chicken cooked in Van Joan in like a creamy sauce. Yum. So usually you have like a whole chicken broken up, cooked in this creamy sauce with this wine mixed through it. And morels, like morels that you put inside as well. And if you want to go all out, and then you usually serve it with rice. So this is the local dish in the region
that
you have.
Sounds amazing.
I think Raymond Blanc even makes, because he's from the Jura,
I can totally see that. Because I was going to say, actually, like, because Lukey loves Jura stuff. Whenever I buy Jura, I usually buy it if he's making something truffly, mushroomy.
Yep.
Like one of my favorite dishes that we paired with a more oxidative Sauvignon was like a cabbage casserole, but in a creamy mushroom. It was like an intense mushroom powder that he had, and then truffle, and it was this sort of like cream umami bomb cabbage dish with
sounds
meat.
Amazing.
With something like this is like, yeah, I could totally get down with that.
Mm.
You know, actually some Austrian food, this sort of like caraway seed and cream and lighter meats like pork or whatever, I could totally see.
Mm.
This is a very nice vin jaune.
I might have changed my mind.
Yeah, it's actually
you're
like...
just saying that because you found out there's a family link to Gewürztraminer now.
No, because I actually think like... But maybe it's like the same, I would happily drink a glass, but maybe in the past having to commit to a whole bottle during dinner has been...
I mean, drinking a whole bottle is quite a commitment as well. I mean, I could do it, but for the everyday person...
It was a commitment that time. Because it also like...
Alone or with somebody?
We were three people.
Okay, that's not so
bad. Then the bottle still took a while. When you're three people, it's not like one glass and then you're moving on. That there are two grape varieties that you don't really see anywhere else, do you? Like so much? Is Poussal and Trousseau grown anywhere else other than Jura?
Exactly, you don't. And the same with Sauvignon. I mean, it pops up in a few places now, but really...
Right.
These are really indigenous grapes to this area.
Because we talked about it before we started recording, that I read somewhere that Sauvignon is actually planted a lot more than we think in Australia because it was misnamed as Albarino for
Albarino,
a long time.
Albarino, yeah.
It was like a mistake with some cuttings that came... So now they're starting to switch over and name it Sauvignon. Or I think they might have a... No, do they make sweet wines? Never mind.
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Yeah, because I was like... You know what? When I cram sometimes the info, it doesn't go in a line. It turns into like a...
spaghetti.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of what's going on. I'm like,
pull this out. Is that the same thing?
It's like a trifle in my head right now. Just like Jello and cream and some bits of fruit salad turning over. So we'll leave that for next time.
Yes. And I think next time we're going to be doing sherry. Right?
Yeah, I'm really excited, actually, because I don't know that much about sherry. It's also not something I drink a lot of, but I know that you are a fan.
I'm a massive sherry fan.
So I'm actually really excited
to go on a virtual journey to Jerez with you for wine, as we can't travel anywhere at the moment.
Yeah, no, and I feel like I can just sit here and have a private lesson for one.
Yes.
All right, and you guys are here too. Fine.
Yeah, so I think until next time.
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at @juice_podcast.
On Instagram at juice.podcast.
And otherwise, you can find us on our own private Instagrams. Emily's on Vina Lupa, and I'm
Gwen's on Gwen Douglas.
Yeah.
Gwen with a U.
Yeah. So until next time.
Until next time.
Cheers!
Cheers!